I would like your attention, please, for some thoughts on Dhamma. We have been all practicing now for several days, and familiarized ourselves with the mind and its many facets. The more we spend time in a closer contemplation of this mind, the more it becomes obvious how many colors we need there. One of the things about retreats is that they don't necessarily provide what we expected to happen. That is one of the major aspects of suffering, of what the Buddha calls dukkha, that which we expect, that which we plan, that which we hope for does not happen. You have sent me many questions. I have many small notes with many questions, and I don't quite know how to tie these questions all together into a reasonably coherent Dhamma talk, so forgive me if some of those questions may have to wait or remain unanswered. Yes, mindfulness and self-awareness, I would say, are the same thing. No, there is no Buddhist cosmic consciousness. In Buddhism, consciousness is generally sense consciousness. So you have no supramundane consciousness, no Brahmanic consciousness, no universal consciousness. You know. Yes, keep practicing metta meditation as long as you can. It's good. Makes the mind happy, makes your relationships more happy, it makes your sleep more sound at night. Definitely keep it up. It's possible to have pain even if your posture is correct, I'm sorry to say. Yes. So. There's two things I wanted to say, to speak about tonight. One thing is about the, you know, what meditation is. We pretend, because we have one single handy word for what we do, we pretend we're actually doing one simple single thing. But this is not true. Meditation is a lot of things. Just to be clear, even in the most conservative estimates of meditation object, you come to more than 40 types of meditation. And if you actually look at the Buddha's teaching, if you look at the suttas themselves, you have even many more than those 40 the commentaries speak of. So the truth is, meditation is not one thing. You know, it is many things. And in that meditation exercise, obviously we shift emphasis. You know? There are things that are necessary before other things become possible. That's the same like with school. There is a developmental aspect to meditation practice. There's a time when you paint with big red color pencils your first letters onto the first into the first school book, yeah. And then there is a time when they tell you it's good to use adjectives, you know. Many adjectives. You know, the more adjectives you use, the more happy they are about you. Mm-hmm. A couple of years later they tell you using many adjectives is childish, you know. Good writers use little adjectives, if at all, you know, and if they use the ones, they use bright ones. So many adjectives is out after that. And so forth. You know? So the same things, you keep doing the same things and they don't actually count anymore suddenly. Now in meditation practice that happens as well. There is much virtue if you learn to make your mind still, if you have a meditation object, if you manage to attach your mind to that meditation object and to stay with it. There is some happiness there is some control there, you will learn a few things of obstacles and so forth, and you may well think this is it. You know, I've learned how to fix my mind on something. It makes me happy if I do that for a few days and I have some power. And then suddenly you find out, actually, you can't do these things anymore. Something has changed in you. You have become somebody else. This is not enough anymore. Meditation suddenly speaks of some things you didn't know were there, that don't fit into your plans of yourself. And for me, it started off in a dancing studio. We were doing Zen meditation there. We didn't even have sitting cushions. We had newspaper bundles which we had taped together, yeah. And we had rented the dancing studio at night, so we were doing Soto Zen, having our faces turned to the wall, you know, sitting on our bundles of newspapers. And I was just sitting there and thinking, from now I'm getting more and more and more intelligent, yeah. So I was sitting there waiting for a big golden boot to give me a huge kick into enlightenment. That's how I started. I was happy that my mind could remember phone numbers better, and I expected this to be coming, you know, a steady and linear path of exponential growth. Yeah. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out that way. So my notion of what meditation is has changed a lot in the course of the years, and I'm trying to find out from you, if we speak, what you're doing and what you're experiencing. There was a time I used to try to use clear Pali terminology, you know, clear meditative language, and I found out this is very useless, you know, because people learn the language, but they don't necessarily have the experience that should go with that language, or they use the language to name very different things. So because they have learned the jargon, it sounds like we're actually talking of the same thing, but we're only using the same jargon. We're not speaking of the same things. So I'm not really interested in using very much jargon these days. I'm interested in listening to what people describe what's happening and finding out what they do with themselves. So meditation as a practice, if we can do it in an orchestrated way like here on this retreat, inevitably means several days of settling the mind, several days of disciplined, that means to some degree controlled, and that means to some degree suppressive activity. Yeah, choosing one object, namely the breath, in favor of all other possible objects, meaning 10,000 thoughts you could have, all the problems you could solve in your life, and so forth. So we favor one object, and we're trying to attach the mind, both either big or small, to that object and accompany that object very, very carefully. We learn to, instead of hop and associate and jump around like the mind usually does, we learn to be with something, even something as boring as the breath sometimes may feel like. And once we have some success in this, suddenly our perspective becomes bigger. Yeah, we have more clarity, we have more quiet, and it is as if we see better. Now, fixing our mind to one area of our experience and making it stay there obviously doesn't solve many of other of our issues. Yeah? It doesn't look after our emotions, it doesn't necessarily produce much insight into our tension. Yeah. So you realize while we try to gain stillness, we do that at the expense of putting part of our lives on shelf. Yeah. Now this can only be a short-term measure, because this meditation is supposed to help us live our lives better. It's not a sort of pastime. It's not a hobby like clay pigeon shooting or something, which you try to get good at, and it has nothing to do with the rest of your life. Meditation is supposed to bring light into the rest of our lives. So there is some point when we need to turn our attention from the chosen object of meditation to the things, to the very things that stop us from getting more quiet, from getting more still. Yeah? Now, when we do that, there is always a risk that these things are stronger than our mindfulness, that they're going to take us and reel us in, yeah? That they're going to catch us. So we have to be very sober and very realistic whether the quality of stillness, the quality of mindfulness we have developed is strong enough to handle the type of question we are tackling. So the moment where we switch from a concentrative, from a samatha type practice to a vipassana type practice has been an object of debate right from the very beginning of Buddhist life. Yeah, you can find discussions in the Pali Suttas where Buddha speak with the where the Buddha tries to pacify. Are we still? Yeah, where the Buddha tries to pacify the monks, because it is obvious that some of them believe that first of all one has to have great concentration before any insight can happen. I haven't done anything.
Your karma.
Yeah. I think this microphone doesn't really like if I talk about meditation. So early on in Buddhist teachings, we find. Okay. We find that there is disagreement in the monks whether the amount of samadhi for insight practice is enough or whether it is not enough.
I'm just trying to turn it off and on.
Yeah?
I don't know.
I thought we had made peace. So, okay, shall we try again? So the Buddha was explaining to his people that some people develop insight after they have developed stillness of mind. Some people develop stillness of mind after they have developed insight, and other people develop both together. So this is a very diplomatic answer for monks who were obviously in disagreement about this matter. To tell you the truth, the discussion about this topic has never stopped for the last 2,500 years, or exactly 2,548 years. It hasn't stopped. So various traditions and various schools of Buddhism argue about how much concentration or unification of mind we need before our insight, before our insights are truly transformative. I suspect this discussion will continue for a while. I would like to tell you what one of my grandfather's teachers, Ajahn Chah, a great monk in Thailand, who is the teacher of my direct teacher, has said about this matter. He described two things that you cannot, if you pick up a stick, you cannot pick up only one end of the stick. If you pick up the stick, you will have inevitably both ends of that stick in hand. So if one end of the stick is insight and the other one is samatha, you will, if you pick up the whole stick, get both things. You know, this is part of one and the same story, although they are different ends at opposing parts of the stick. They are inevitably and inalienably part of one piece of experience. Another, maybe even more telling example he has given is, he described insight practice without samatha, he described like lighting matches. You know, you go into the dark, there's many caves in Thailand, and you try to see what it is, how much bat shit there is about, or things like that. So you try to find your way in that cave, you strike a match, and you see a little bit for a short moment, and then you get burnt on your fingers, and then it gets dark again. This, he described, is like insight without samatha. Samatha without insight, he described, is like making a candle, you know, one of these really nice wax candles. You dip the wick into the wax, the liquid one, then into the water, then you dry it, and you back to the wax. So the candle grows nice and fat and strong, but it's not lit. So the samatha obviously should meet the light of the inside, and the two together will give enough sustenance and enough light to for us to gain clarity and orient in our lives, orient in what's happening in our minds. How does this translate into a meditation retreat? It translates that for the first part of a retreat, generally 3 days, if we have a retreat that is longer than 3 days, you would like to dedicate this time to samatha practice. You would like to make the mind still. That means you put the big questions aside, not because they're not valid or they don't matter, but you can't straight away turn to those big questions because the mind hasn't gotten the weight, the clarity, the transparency, the stillness to stay with a big question. It will think. If you turn it to the question, it'll just kind of go up in flames and say, yeah. For that, you don't need to come to Endor. You can do that anywhere, really. Mm-hmm. So the encouragement is, given the amount of time you have, you spend a good chunk of your time on developing stillness. The same applies when you go home. If you have an hour to sit, I suggest you spend at least half of your time doing samatha type practices. That means centering, getting ground beneath your bum, earthing, letting the mind become still. It means you don't try to do insight, you don't try to tackle anicca, dukkha, anatta. What you're trying to do is to center the heart. You take refuge, you breathe, and you're trying to deepen your stillness. That means disciplined, strategic, and orchestrated disbelief in thought. It means suspension of judgment. It means turning away from the most burning issues in your heart. The willingness to put aside, to let go, to park, to clear the space. Yeah. These are things which are inevitable necessities for the type of clarity I'm speaking of. I do not believe in a practice of choiceless awareness without any depth of stillness in your mind. Choiceless awareness is a great practice if you have some stillness of mind. But any issue in your life that has some weight, anything with plenty of emotion, anything which triggers fears, desire, hatred, is likely to completely overwhelm you unless you have some perspective, and a perspective that comes from stillness and distance. So this has to be clear. You know, we're not teaching think tricks. You cannot sit still and make yourself believe that you could practice insight. This may be the moment to say that the notion of insight, the term vipassana, which has become a brand name and which is used as a term for practice, if you look actually how the Buddha uses that term, it's not quite the way we seem to use it today. What you notice is the Buddha doesn't use the term very much. Yeah? When the Buddha says monks meditate, he doesn't say monks do vipassana. He says monks practice stillness. Yeah. Jayate, jayati bhikkhave, jayante. So he makes the monks actually practice stillness. He doesn't say do vipassana. Further, if you look closer, you see that he never speaks about vipassana, or very rarely does he speak about vipassana without almost within the same breath mentioning stillness of mind. So it's always samatha vipassana. And then you will notice that he seems to, in most of the cases, he seems to use the term vipassana not as the type of exercise you do, but vipassana is what happens as a result of your practice. Yeah? It's the insight itself. It's not what you do, but it's what you get. So it's the fruition of your practice. So there may be a slight misunderstanding if we make ourselves believe we could just kind of come here, sit on our cushions and do vipassana. Yeah. There may be a simplification or a reductionism happening here. Now, I do think that this is a very powerful exercise where the Buddha asks us to look at our experience. Because obviously, if you just kind of keep trying to make the mind still, you may have the talent for this, or you may not have the talent for this. But even if you do have the talent for this, that stillness is conditioned. Once the conditions that supported that stillness go away, the stillness will go away. Yeah? You cannot convert it at the end of the retreat. If you have not translated that stillness into wisdom, into intuitive, insightful wisdom, that stillness will go away. You know, when you go out and go about the things you have to go about, then the supportive condition for samatha are gradually dwindling away. And you will find yourself confronted by the very same problems that you started off with. So samatha, as nice as it feels and as indispensable as it is not really going to get you out. You know, even the most refined states of jhanic experience are limited temporally. You can't stay there for very long. And they are not liberating. You can be very, very concentrated, and you can lose this concentration, and you can live a happily deluded life after that. This is perfectly possible. There is no guarantee that strong concentrative state is going to give you insight. You're likely to meet some, really, to make some insightful things aside, but already in the Buddhist time, there were people who were quite accomplished in concentration, who were doing all kinds of strange things. Yeah? The Buddha was very critical of. There's a famous teaching called the Brahmacala Sutta, the beginning of the Digha Nikaya, which enumerates 62 types of wrong view, and most of these wrong views are held by people who are very accomplished in meditation practice. Yeah. So jhana, that is what the Buddhist contribution is to meditational culture or a contemplative culture, jhana, the in-depth experience of profound samadhi, is not liberative as such. That's what the Buddha said. He said, what makes Buddhist meditation to Buddhist meditation is the insight part. Yeah? Insofar that insight bit is very important. Now, what does it mean, insight? Who is having insight into what? Insight strictly means that we recognize in any aspect of our experience, any aspect we can have in the four bases, in the four foundations of mindfulness. Remember, body, feeling, tone, the mind itself, or the heart, citta, and finally Dhamma, those four TV channels I've spoken to you two nights ago. In any experience, in any of those channels that we constantly see impermanence, the truth of anicca, that we constantly see the quality of unsatisfactoriness that is inevitable in there, and that we constantly recognize the characteristic of impersonality, that the experience we have does not belong to us. We are not this experience. This experience is not ourself. To remain conscious of these three characteristics any moment of our experience, this is what truly constitutes vipassana. Yeah. So, the other part of the question, what takes insight into these experiences, is more tricky to say, because you can't really, any moment you start to identify with the aspect in your mind that is capable of knowing, that aspect becomes a thing in itself. Yeah. So as soon as you say, I am the insight, this I you have created becomes an object within the four satipatthanas. It is transient. Yeah, there is nothing which you can really call yourself. That I becomes an aspect of suffering, because as soon as you say I, it's going to hurt at some point in your life, very soon, because somebody else comes in and has a bigger I, or you think you're an intelligent I, and then somebody comes and has an even more intelligent I, and then you have to battle with him. Or it's going to fade, you know. If nobody tells you for 10 minutes that you have an intelligent I, you start getting a little wobbly, you know. You need a shot to approve that. So somebody needs to give you a pat on the back, or you need to say something clever and people need to applaud, or you need to be seen by somebody whom you like, so otherwise you start feeling a bit insecure of that I. And rightly so. The problem with that I is it doesn't exist. Yeah? It's a construction of your mind. Maybe part-time useful construction, but not really something that you can truly take refuge in. Where does the eye go when you go to sleep? There's a Tibetan practice that says, when you sneeze, you know, you have a truly selfless moment. Where is your eye at the moment of sneezing? Yeah. So, one of the things inside meditation tries to establish is a continual awareness of these three characteristics of existence. And you will find, although they may sound a little frightening, in fact, if you go there and live with a continual awareness of these three characteristics of existence, strangely, you find yourself happy. There's something that comes up that has to do with, it's a great freedom not having to be somebody. It's a great freedom not having to be a problematic self that needs continual propping up and repairing, you know, and reinforcing, and that goes into competition with other selves, because as soon as you have a couple of these selves together, they generally go into a little quarrel. So that is what we try to do in the second part of meditation, when we make a conscious decision that now, instead of treating the things that come up in our mind, yeah, which we have said are hindrances or are things that distract us from our breathing practice, now we say, I voluntarily turn to these things. I'm not labeling them as obstacles or hindrances, I'm not trying to park them, but I'm trying to be with them. I'm trying to just be with that feeling in the pit of my stomach that speaks of sadness or that speaks of frustration. I'm trying to be with it not by thinking about it, not by analyzing it, but I'm trying to be with it with a quality of awareness that is staying there, yeah, that really truly scrutinizes, it investigates, it establishes change, yeah? It establishes the phenomenology of change. Because something changes, it means it is based on conditions. Because something changes, it means it doesn't have a substance. Because something changes, it means it doesn't belong to me. It has no inherent existence. Now that's not the same as being real. Yeah? The universe is quite real, although it is impermanent. It changes. It can go away. But it happens. It's not an illusion. Our senses are not an illusion. Birth is not an illusion. Death is not an illusion. All these things happen. We're really here. This is not a bad dream. So, this careful, yeah? There are other teachings which say this is just one big Maya, you know? This is just, you know, mother's play, yeah? Lila. Or this is just a big illusion of consciousness. You're not really existing here. All you are, you're just modulations of my consciousness, in fact. There's nothing out there. Yeah? That's not what the Buddha says. The Buddha says, it's happening, it's real, but it changes. If you want to own it, it's going to hurt you. If you want to make a self out of it, it's not going to function. It's not yours. It belongs to principles, universal principles. Imagine the coarsest way of getting to have something is probably to take it and put it in your mouth and gobble it down. Yeah? Even if this is a very direct and fairly clear act of appropriation. Yeah? You put something and you ingest it, you metabolize it. Yeah? You can't really get hold of things much more than that. But even then, it doesn't really belong to you. You know? You can take some nourishment from it, and then it goes its way. You know, by laws you haven't decided. You know? By laws you have very little influence. You can't say, I'm going to breathe in and that's it. End of breathing. Finished. I'm done with that. Fine breath. That's it. Or the halva you may have eaten tonight, you know, so I'm going to hang on to this halva forever. You know? This halva is my true self-essence. You know? The sweetness of the halva is my true self-essence. It doesn't really work, you know, your stomach doesn't think that way. Your intestines don't think that way. They don't give a damn about what you think up there, you know. They just do their business. They know what to do with the halva. So, you see, the absurdity of ownership in a true existential sense is very, very crass. So that is what selflessness means. That is what impersonality means. It is empty of a permanent self. It is empty of something that is truly staying stable. These three hallmarks, they are woven into all of our experience.
Can you repeat the three?
Yes, the first one, the adjective is called anicca, which means impermanence, transitoriness. Yeah? The noun for it is anicca-ta, which means things are not impermanent, but it's impermanence itself. The second one is called dukkha, which we translate generally with unsatisfactoriness. That's the best one. Dukkha-ta is the noun. Yeah? The ta bit at the end is the, I don't know how you would create an abstract noun in Hebrew. Good, you've heard it.
America.
Okay, good. That's it. That's the way it works in Pali. So you have dukkha, the adjective, dukkata, the noun of it, yeah, for unsatisfactoriness. And the last one is anatta, or anattang, if you want a pronoun. And the condition is called anattata, yeah, which I translate with impersonality or selflessness. Now, these three characteristics are woven into everything we can experience across our six senses. Yeah, so the six senses I've spoken of, or they are woven into everything into the four foundations of mindfulness, or they are woven into the five aspects of our experience, body experience, pleasure and pain experience, sanya, perceptional experience, sankhara, the experience of volitional forces and formations of mind, and vijnana, sense consciousness. All things we can experience have the stamp of these three characteristics of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, and of impersonality on them. I'd like to fish out one of these aspects tonight because it's an often misunderstood one. It's the aspect of dukkha. Buddhists are famous for that because they harp a lot around on dukkha. The Buddha stated that dukkha is the first noble truth. Now the word dukkha means literally a space that is hard to bear. Yeah. A bit more precisely, du as a prefix means something that is ordinary, something that is narrow, and something that is dirty. Yeah. So it's constricted, it's base, and it's dirty. And ka means generally space, particularly small spaces. One example for a small space is if you have an old ox cart. Imagine an old ox cart with a wooden axle and wheels, wooden wheels, and the wooden wheels has spokes and has a hub, and the place where the axle hits the hub of the wheel, generally this is a sort of a prong, four corners, four sides, a prong, a rectangular prong, wooden prong that goes into the space that is in the wheel's hub. Yeah, if you are with me on car engineering 5th century BC, this space in the hub is ka, is an example for ka. It's narrow, it's dirty, and it's constricted, and on top of it, it goes round and round and round and round. And those of you who are familiar with Buddhist teaching will be reminded of another term the Buddha has for this kind of round and round and round experience, which he calls samsara. Samsarati means roll on. Yeah? Not rock on, but roll on. So dukkha, which when we translate it with suffering, is sold too short, you see. The term dukkha means a lot more than we mean with the term suffering in English. It's important to understand the breadth of this term, otherwise much of the Buddhist teaching doesn't make sense. Yeah? The Buddha feels that dukkha is something that is a problem for all of us unless we are really truly free. Now, many of you probably would say they are not suffering right now, because on the suffering we think, a serious headache or some kidney problem or a broken leg or a severe case of heartache or something like that, we would probably call suffering. But many forms of discomfort we wouldn't call suffering. But in a Buddhist understanding, dukkha is what separates you now from complete enlightenment. The Buddha assumes that human beings can be absolutely happy and absolutely free and awake, and if they are not that, then what separates them?
Try it again.
Battery dead. I had to feel like it worked solid.
That's it.
Shall I try again?
No, it's not going to work.
Okay. Do you have a battery?
Yeah.
It's working.
It's amazing.
Yeah, there are miracles, isn't it? Let's hold your breath, otherwise they stop. So, the Buddha thinks dukkha is something that separates us now, if we are not completely free or completely happy. That means dukkha can be anything from very powerful physical pain to emotional agony to very, very subtle forms of discontent, very subtle forms of unhappiness, of longing, of very fine degrees of lack of satisfaction. Yeah? So that's important. If you have the feeling, you know, when the Buddha teaches, I only teach two things, namely the arising of suffering and the cessation of suffering, you may think, if you don't understand dukkha properly, you may think, I don't have any of this, I don't know what's the problem. You know, can't we just be natural in this world? Yeah. So the whole scope of the Buddha's teaching hinges on our proper understanding how pervasive this quality of dukkha is in our lives. Now, what are examples of dukkha? There's some very straight examples. The Buddha says birth is suffering. The fact that we are being born inevitably entails that we will die. It entails that we have to do difficult things. We have to go through a developmental approach, yeah, which starts from early days after conception and a dramatic expulsion through a birth channel, and then a steep learning process getting to handle the so-called conventional outside reality of mother's belly, and then school and the whole story. You know it all. So just being born means we're in for a lot of trouble. Yeah. It doesn't mean that there is no happiness or no pleasure, but however much pleasure and happiness there is also a lot of trouble. The Buddha says very starkly that illness, sickness, is a form of dukkha. He says aging is a form of dukkha. And he says death is a form of dukkha. He says further that being together with people we don't like is a form of dukkha. Being separated from people we do like is a form of dukkha. Not getting what we want is a form of dukkha. And finally, all forms of attachment to individual aspects of our experience will constitute suffering in one or the other shape. So, dukkha is a pretty big number. Let's look at some definitions of how we can understand different types of dukkha. First of all, there is bodily dukkha, plain pain. There is mental dukkha. Yeah. A type of dukkha you get when you hear a dissonance. Yeah. Dissonant sound produces a type of dukkha. Bad aesthetics, bad interior design produce a type of dukkha. Formulas which don't work produce a type of dukkha. These are little, simple and stupid examples of mental pain. There's a lot of examples of emotional pain. Any sort of frustration, stress is a classic for dukkha. Grief, anger, hatred, envy, jealousy, spite, all these sort of things are intensely painful states. Shame, guilt. So in many ways they are not surprising. We know that this is painful. We know this is not nice. But the Buddha says further, besides a type of dukkha he calls dukkha dukkata, which is the pain bit, the painfulness of anger or the painfulness of a toothache. This is fairly straightforward. There are other types of pain. There is a type of pain that comes with things that are nice, yeah, which is maybe less obvious. Why should things that are nice suddenly have something to do with dukkha? Well, things that are nice, they may take effort to obtain. So there is the dukkha of the effort to obtain the nice thing. If you enjoy the nice thing, you might find out that after a while you enjoy it less. Yeah. There is the pain of decreasing or diminishing returns, I think, is the economical term. You invest more and you get less and less back. Yeah. Or you find out that the same thing doesn't give you the same amount of pleasure anymore. It decreases in returns. Or it doesn't. It is wonderful, it is delicious, as in the first moment, and for some reason it doesn't stop giving you pleasure. But suddenly the fear creeps up that it might stop, yeah? Or that somebody else might get it before you get it, yeah? Or that you may suddenly get too old to do that, yeah? So even the things which are unabashedly pleasurable and pleasant may hold some degree of dukkha, because you may lose them, or you may want to protect them, or you may want to safeguard them for the rest of your life. And that is considered a form of unsatisfactoriness. It's a sort of sadness which may creep in, or a sort of protectiveness which may creep in. Or simply, you know, you get bored. You do one thing that was absolutely ecstatic when you did it the first time, and after 100 times it has lost some of its punch, it has lost some of its juice, and you look for contrast, you look for variation. You need an alternative, because you have lost the taste for it. Something in you has jaded. Yeah? Because the way our senses work is they get habituated, you know. Like I said, our brains are anticipatory in nature. They expect things to repeat how it has already happened. Once something has happened a couple of times, we expect it to happen again in that way. That can be very time-saving on one level. On another level, we may lose the taste for something. Because we know something, it has lost its freshness, it has lost its delight. So there's a kind of diminishing experience with the same apparent experience. So this is a type of dukkha. Then there is another type of dukkha which has to do with the fact that all things we experience as pleasurable, in fact all things we can experience anyway, have conditions as support. So if these conditions are not continually maintained, you know, they drop away. Something crumbles. So even if you get nice things, you need maintenance. You know, your car needs maintaining. Your house needs maintaining. Relationships need maintaining. Your garden, you know. Everything you like, everything you cherish, needs in some form effort to be staying in place. Because otherwise it goes a little dirty, or it goes rusty, or something happens to it. Imagine how much health needs maintaining, or how much how much looking after the body means. Yeah? There's a lot of maintenance that has to go into things we like. So there is a dukkha that comes from having to continually put effort into maintaining things. Yeah? And you begin to see that dukkha is almost in everything we can touch. It's possible to suffer with it. Now there are yet another distinction in between dukkha. There is a type of dukkha which is inevitable. Even the Buddha had back pain. Sometimes he would say, "Tonight I'm tired, Sariputta, you give the Dhamma talk. I'm leaning my back against a pillar." This was a completely enlightened human being. So even a completely enlightened human being has back pain. Yeah. Take comfort, those of you with back pain. But then there is a type of suffering on top of the back pain. See how much aversion we have against the back pain, or how much indignation we have about having a back pain. This can make the back pain considerably worse. Yeah. So there's a type of pain that comes with the fact that we're born as human beings, with human bodies which have specific needs and which can, things can go wrong with these bodies. And then we struggle with the pain we experience, or we struggle with the discomfort. And suddenly, what was a little bit of pain can become an absolute agony because we fight against it. So if you fight against your pain in the knee, your pain in the knee can become really an infernal experience. And yet, if you can take it back, you don't need to be a Buddha to do that. If you can take the fighting back, suddenly the pain in the knee becomes just that, a pain in the knee. There's a huge difference. So this difference in dukkha is the difference between the suffering I add through the creation of unskillful use of my senses, unskillful use of particularly my thinking and my emotional world. So the Buddha asks us, when we meet with pain, to take this as a sign that there is something to be learned. The Buddha says, there would be no enlightenment, there would be no growth and no progress in this teaching and discipline if there weren't three things. One of them is old age, sickness and death. You know, these are the three worst types of suffering in some way. So the Buddha says, if there wasn't pain as a messenger to teach us, we would probably not learn. Now, if you put your hand on your heart and you say, tell me that you will you learn if there is no suffering in your life? If you get everything you want, will you really still be interested in learning something? If I put my hand there, I have to say no. You know, one of the things that stops me from learning often is being happy. I'm a lot more interested in learning if I feel pain, if I don't get what I want, if things happen in my life that are dangerous or crisis or frustrating, then I'm interested in learning. So the aspect of suffering in our lives is generally a signal. Something needs to be learned here. Something has been attached to and now it hurts. So the first noble truth is a noble truth because it makes our heart more clear. Clear what is important, clear what are the troublesome forces in there. So the truth of suffering, as the first of his four truths, is something to be understood. It's not something to be ashamed of. You know, sometimes we have suffering and we're kind of embarrassed. We think, oh God, I hope nobody sees it. You know, it's bad enough it happens to me. I don't really want this to be known in public. So we are kind of embarrassed or we are ashamed of, because we think it's a personal defeat or a personal failure. Now what the Buddha says, no, it's not a personal failure. Suffering is a universal quality. The type of suffering he means with dukkha is something that is in all of our lives. And however rich, however clever, however privileged, however gifted you are, you're going to experience it. There's no way around it. It's very, very democratic. Yeah. So rather than be embarrassed about it, he asks us in his first teaching to investigate suffering. To investigate suffering firstly means we have to suffer. We have to say, yes, it hurts. Yes, yes, indeed, that is unpleasant. Yes, indeed, that is truly painful. As long as we're in denial and say, everything's all right, no, thank you, don't need anything, we're fine here, you know, just okay. As long as we're in that stage of denial, pretending it's not happening to us, there is very little Buddhist teaching can do for you. Once you start admitting that things are painful in your life, that's what the Buddha asks you. Before he says, believe in me or take refuge in me, he says, listen, is there pain in your life? If there is pain in your life, you might want to listen to this. I have a hypothesis about how pain comes about. As long as you say, no, thank you, we don't have any pain, we don't need any spiritual teachings, we're fine as it is. Yeah. Very little, Buddhist teaching is very little to offer. It doesn't threaten you, you know, it doesn't say you go to hell if you don't believe in me, or you'll be punished forever. seven generations downwards or something. It doesn't say that type of thing. It says, I can, if you're interested, I can tell you something about suffering and how it arises. If you want to investigate this, not in principle, but in your own heart. And that's, I think, what meditation is geared to, help us do that investigation better. Help us look and be with the suffering that takes place in our hearts, in our lives, in our minds. To, you know, first of all, we learn to suffer more consciously. You may hate to hear this. You know, you may want happiness and compassion and bliss. But actually what we do is we try to suffer less and learn more. Yeah? If suffering is the reason why we're interested in learning and growing, we like to suffer more elegantly. Yeah? We like that it takes less suffering before we start learning. So the Buddha's advice is in the First Noble Truths that to understand suffering, we have to be willing to be with it, to stop denying it, to be honest about it, and to investigate the nature of our suffering. Rather than trying to run away from it and be happy, he tells us, and this is very counterintuitive, he tells us to actually look at, feel, investigate into the very things that we would like to run away from, yeah? That which creates pain. And he says, this is the direct path to happiness. If you learn how your suffering is created and how you are responsible in creating this suffering, how you are responsible in not looking at it. And by not looking at it, it is going to repeat itself because you have refused to learn. So this is the big picture of our meditation practice. I'd like to leave it at that. Please consider the term dukkha, although we translate it with suffering, is much bigger than what we call suffering and covers all kinds of subtle aspects, subtle shades of unsatisfactoriness, discontent, longing, lacking. The experience of desire particularly is also considered an aspect of dukkha. To not be happy as we are, wanting it to be different, is particularly an aspect of dukkha. So this is a powerful and great teaching, and to the degree we can allow this to touch us, we can benefit from the Buddhist teaching. To the degree we refuse the validity of this, obviously Buddhist teachings will not really help a lot. It's like the doctor. You go to the doctor, and if you don't go to the doctor and say, it hurts here, please help, the doctor can't really do much for you. You have to actually go there and say, listen, look at this. It has turned blue. Is this okay? Yeah? Unless we're willing to do that, because we're ashamed of having a blue finger, or we're ashamed of saying, it hurts, or I can't cope anymore. Unless we're willing to do that, very little can be done for us from the great medicine man. So, enough of me for tonight. I thank for your patience, and the forces that are responsible for the functioning of the microphone and the loudspeaker be praised as well. Good. Yeah. It was whispered, some devatas, I have been whispered to in my ears, some devatas in the kitchen have produced sustenance, sweet and nourishing sustenance. So I think we are invited to go over there and see what these devatas have produced for us, and maybe partake in some goodness. Devatas are sublime beings, generally good-natured, generally well-disposed to meditating practitioners, and sometimes they produce energy balls. So, let's go and find out whether this is true. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. I think about 10 minutes of walking would be fine. Or helping those.
Okay, the devatas tell me we need to do more walking meditation. Somehow, our spiritual merit isn't quite there, but it's not much missing. You know, we're very close, but I think 10-15 minutes walking meditation could just about bring us to the spot. Yeah? So there will be a bell, And you might want to check out the kitchen after that bell.
Yeah.
After that, you come back in here, well nourished and strengthened for some more meditation practice, to build up your spiritual merit account even more.